Okay, hello everyone. Welcome to today's session. It's a session on application lifecycle, isolated storage, and the local database in Windows Phone Mango. Now you might wonder what do these things have in common, or why are they grouped together in a session? Well, actually, your execution model governs the lifecycle of your application, and by that I mean you go through different states in your application. Your application can be terminated, it can go into tombstone, dormant states. I will go into that. And so you need some kind of mechanism to save state in your application if you want to provide a good user experience. And that's where the isolated storage and a local database on top of isolated storage comes into play. So that's why these are grouped together in one session. But maybe I should start by introducing myself. My name is Kevin. I work at Real Dolmen, where I am a technical consultant. Mainly, I come from a web background, so I've mainly created or been project lead on web applications. Went to Silverlight applications after that. And so for me, it's a bit of a logical step to also work with Windows Phone applications due to the link with Silverlight. My coordinates are on screen, so you can contact me or have a look at my blog or send me a message on Twitter if you've got any questions afterwards. I've also authored a book together with Gilles Clairen, who some of you will probably know. It's called Silverlight 5 Data and Services Cookbook. It's the successor to the Silverlight 4 Data and Services Cookbook. And it should be available at the end of March, so within a month. It's mainly focused on building line of business applications with Silverlight 5, but it also includes a chapter on Windows Phone, and a lot of the techniques in there are, of course, applicable to Windows Phone. But I promise that's all the commercial stuff I will talk about. Okay, so the agenda. I'll start by introducing the Windows Phone Mango application lifecycle. So what are the states and what are the events that are triggered between going to the states, or what events will lead to going to which states. The Windows Phone Mango application lifecycle is a bit different than the Windows Phone application lifecycle. So there's been a few changes with the previous version. So even for people who were used to working with Windows Phone 7 programming for it, you will find a few things have changed. And I'll look into each of the events, and we'll also look into a few best practices on how you should handle those. And we're going to start building an application. So we'll build an application that goes through all the different states, and we'll see how we can save states. We'll see how we can save states while your application is dormant or tombstoned. We'll see how we can ensure our state is saved between different instances of your application starting up. And we'll see how we can make sure the performance is still good. And after that, we will go to the local database, another new feature in Windows Phone Mango, which is, of course, also a way to save your state, your data, more into relational data, let's say. And for those of you who are used to link to SQL, this will all look pretty familiar. And of course, we'll end with conclusion and Q&A. So, the Windows Phone Mango application lifecycle. I've already said the execution model governs the lifecycle of the applications. And it's very important to get this right. Because, well, a user should always have, of course, fast and responsive experience. When you're building an application for Windows Phone, I guess you want your application to be the one users want to use. If you look at the marketplace, you will see for most applications there are alternatives for those same applications built by other people. One of the ways to make your application stand out is to make sure you have or you offer the user a fast and responsive experience. So the user should be able, should not have to wait too long for your application to start up. He should see the application in the same state when he comes back from task switching, from multitask switch. Now, there is actually no true multitasking, for your own applications. But what the application lifecycle does is it helps create this illusion for the user. So also, this adds up to a better user experience. And as a developer, which I guess we all are, you use this application lifecycle and the corresponding states to achieve this. So it all comes down to having a good, fast, responsive user experience, actually. And in my opinion, for mobile applications, that's one of the most important things you should ensure your application can deliver. So, this is probably one of the most important slides of this slide deck. It shows you all the different states, and it shows you how a user can go from one state to another. As you can see, we've got a running state. This is where your application will be, the state your application will reside in most of the time. Your user, while doing stuff in the application, while navigating from one view to another, he will stay in the running state. Next, we see the dormant and tombstone state, which I'll get to in a minute. Let's start on top. The top rectangle you see there, application launching event. Well, logically, this is triggered when your user initiates the application. So the user starts the application, your application launches, and this is typically where you will want to start loading some data, or you want to make sure your application starts up correctly. You want to make sure it initializes correctly. So all the stuff you do when your application launches should logically go into the launching event. As you can see, you also get page unnavigated to and unnavigated from methods. Those are, of course, triggered when you go from one view to another. Now we're in running state. Your application will keep on being in running state for quite a while. And let's say the user navigates forward. By navigating forward, I mean the user presses start button, Windows button, on your on this Windows phone. So he navigates away from the app. He's not going backwards. That's by pressing the back button all of the time, your user can also exit the application. That's not what happens here. The user moves forward, so he exits your application by pushing the Windows button, the start button, or by launching a search screen, something like that. He goes to another application, to another part of the operating system. What happens then? Well, first of all, the page unnavigated from method gets executed because you're navigating away from a view, and your application gets deactivated. So you go into the deactivated event. This is pretty important because after you went through the deactivated event, your user can activate his application again by going back to that application. Now, as you can see on the picture, your application can go into two different states after having been deactivated: the dormant state and the tombstone state. Dormant state is a new one that was introduced in Windows Phone Mango, so here's the big difference between the previous version and this version. What's the dormant state? Well, that's, as a developer, that's the easiest thing you can imagine. Automatically, your application will go into dormant state when the user navigates forward from your application. And when the user goes back to the application and goes into the activated event, your state will have automatically been saved. So this is the easiest you can get as a developer, because, well, you have to do nothing. Your application state will automatically be saved. Everything will continue to work as normal. However, that would probably be a bit too easy. Your application doesn't necessarily stay in this dormant state. So dormant state actually means the threads are stopped, no processing takes place, but your app is still intact in memory. However, your operating system can decide that after a while, well, I need more memory for other applications to run. So your operating system will automatically put your application from a dormant state to a tombstone state. And this tombstone state, well, this actually means your application has been terminated, but information about where you are in the application and state dictionaries will have been preserved. So this is one step beyond dormant state. Dormant state, all your state information is saved. Tombstone state, the state dictionaries are saved. This means that we can save state in the state dictionaries, which we can then check when our application gets activated again, and then we can fetch the data from those dictionaries and use them to get our correct state back in our application. But we're not finished yet. The operating system can have decided to put the application in tombstone state, but it can only leave about 5 applications in tombstone state. After that, so if a user uses his phone and launches more than 5 applications, or well, rather, more than 5 applications have been put into tombstone state, and yours one was the first one on the list, your application will completely be removed from memory, including the state dictionaries. So that's actually the same that happens when your application is terminated. So all state information is lost. So in essence, and this is very important, this means that when a user navigates forward, 3 things can happen afterwards. The user returns while the application is in a dormant state, nothing must happen. The user returns while it's in a tombstone state, which means you should have saved state information in the dictionaries and get it back. Or your application is completely removed from memory before the user uses it again. So in that case, you also need to make sure you have saved your state somewhere else than in the state dictionaries. Those are the 3 possibilities. Now there's one more. This was all by navigating forward. A user can, of course, also navigate backward to exit your application. That means he starts your application, does a few things, presses the back button a few times, and that actually means your application is immediately terminated. So you do not go into the deactivated event. You will not go into the activated event when the user returns to the application. No, you actually go to the closing event. So this means that in the closing event, you too should find a way to save state that must be preserved across application instances. So with this explanation, a rather lengthy explanation, I think we've covered all the states that are possible. So let's look into the events that can execute and lead to some of the states. First, we've got the launching event. Happens when a new instance of the application is launched by the user. It's very important that the user expects a fresh instance, which starts up quickly. So this means in the launching event, you should not do stuff like ensure the user goes to a certain page in the application where he last left off. That's something that can happen in the activated event, but not in the launching event. Launching should always mean the user expects a fresh instance and gets a fresh instance. So a few best practices. The code you execute in the launching event should not take a lot of time. You should avoid resource-heavy tasks. And what can you do for this? Well, you can perform them when the application is launched, or you can do them on a background thread. It's very important to know that there's a 10-second limit on this event, as are on comparable events like activated, deactivated, and closing. This means once this 10-second limit has been reached, your app will automatically terminate. So you have to make sure you never reach this 10-second limit, which is why it's a good idea to do performance-heavy stuff on a background thread. So that's what's important about the launching event. Now we've got the deactivated event. So the user navigates forward. It's also fired when a tutor or launcher is launched or the lock screen is activated. It's also important to know. After that, you also go back to the activated event. And a few best practices here are you could store the application state into the state dictionary, which you can then restore in the activated event. And you should probably also save persistent state, because as said, it's not guaranteed your application will be reactivated through the activated event. It could be that your application goes from dormant to tombstone to completely removed from memory. And again, you've got this 10-second limit here. Third one of four, deactivated again event. This one's fired when an application returns from a dormant or tombstone state. And in this event, you get a few event arguments in which you can check one value, the is application instance preserved value. If this one is true, that's actually a new feature of Windows Phone Mango again. If this one is true, then you know you are returning from a dormant state and you don't have to do anything. If this is false, you know you're returning from a tombstone state, and then you should use the state dictionaries to get your state information back. So next to that, also you should avoid resource heavy operations here, and you should ensure everything gets done into these 10 seconds. And then lastly, the closing event. This one is triggered when the user navigates back out of your application. And here you do not store data in a state dictionary, because after a closing event, a user will never get to the activated event. So your state dictionaries will be lost anyway. So you should store it somewhere persistent, isolated storage, for example. And again, you've got a 10-second limit here. Okay, that was a lot of theory. Now let's put this to practice with a little demo application. Okay, here we go. I am quickly going to show you the application. I'm not going to go into my breakpoints yet, just to show you what we're doing here. It's actually a very simple application. You've probably seen this before or made one of these yourself. It's a simple to-do list. Got a bunch of to-do items. You can add a few items to them or you can edit them. That's actually it. So I've made a very simple application. And why? Well, because even though it's a very simple application, it contains everything we need to know or we need to look into when talking about state preservation. So it's a lot easier to understand and to explain with a small application. Okay. General overview of the application. I built this application using the model view view model pattern. In this case, using MVVM Lite. And probably something some of you will know, maybe some people don't know it. MVVM Lite is an external dependency, and there's a very cool way to manage external dependencies for your application. That's called NuGet. You can download this at nuget.org. Then you get this nice interface in Visual Studio, and you can easily install packages, external dependencies from this UI. The necessary dependencies will get added as reference to your application and will be put on your local system in a nice packages directory. So by far the easiest way to manage external dependencies is NuGet. So you might want to look into it. It's just a quick tip. I've got two views. An overview view. Let's look into that one. Okay, I hope everyone can see this correctly. And this is our list box. So we've got a list box here. Let's make it a bit bigger. That's bound to a list of to-do items. Selected item is bound to the current item. And it contains a very simple data template bound to a name and a description. There's of course also a one item view, which is in essence just one view bound to one current item. That's very simple for anyone who's programmed any Windows Phone application or simple or even Spotlight application. Our model is the one to do item. Implements iNotify property changed, and it simply contains an ID, a name, a description, and I've created a few constructors just to make life a bit easier to initialize my my data. And of course, I've got my view models. View model is the data context of the view if you're working in a model view, view model pattern. And it actually exists to manipulate your model in such a way that it's usable by your view. So the view model sits between the view and the model, and it actually takes your model, makes, to say it, well, to make it easy to explain, it takes your model and it does some operations on that. So there are properties on your view model that can be bound to your view. That's the simplest explanation of MVVM, actually. Okay. Then there's something else I need. I need some kind of local data store. I need somewhere where I want to put my data that should be available throughout my application. You can do this on each view model. I typically opt to create a local store class. As you can see here. And this local store actually contains the items I am going to bind to in my views. So what happens here is my view models, they link back to items in my local store. And that's actually a pretty easy way of working when you want collections to be available throughout your application instead of just on a specific view model. So therefore, I've got a local store class, which contains a list of to-do items, the current item, and as you can see, I've also created an initialize method, which simply loads me some dummy data. So this is the dummy data that would typically get loaded the first time I start my application, just to have something in here, let's say. And that's actually all there is to it. Now, let's look into all that state stuff I was talking about. Here we go. Most of this happens in application.xaml.cs because that's where your launching, activated, deactivated events take place. So let's start with the beginning. My application launching event. Simple initialization. I initialize new instance of my local store. And I initialize it by stating it should generate some dummy data. That's all I do. I can now look at the application activated event. Nothing happens here. And in my deactivated event, same way, nothing happens. What does this mean for my application? So there we go. If I run this one, I launch, the store gets initialized. I get my application. Let's say I edit. Let's see, MSDN. And go back. Confirm. And now I'm going to navigate forward from my application, which I can simply do by pressing the Windows button here. And as expected, I end up in my deactivated event. I do nothing in there. Just run through it. And now I should go back to my application. The application should be in dormant state now. So if I go back, it should get activated. And indeed, I end up in the activated event. I do nothing here, no code. And as you can see, my state has been preserved, by which I mean the MSDN I added. It's still there on screen. Why is this? Well, as I said, if an application gets activated and it's coming from a dormant state, state is preserved automatically. So, as you can guess, that's by far the easiest. However, you have no guarantee that your application will stay in dormant state. Might as well go to tombstone state or be terminated. So I should find a way to debug this in tombstone state. There's a little trick for that, because it's the operating system that will choose when your application will go to tombstone state. Now, if you're debugging, it would be pretty annoying to have to launch a few other applications in the hope that your application will go to tombstone state. So there's a simple setting in the project properties of your application. In the debug tab, you can check tombstone upon deactivation while debugging. Comes in very handy. This means that when I navigate forward from my application, the dormant state will be skipped and we automatically go into tombstone state, which makes it a lot easier to test this in debug mode. So let's run this again, still without having added any code. And if everything goes right, something should crash, of course. So let's save this. Okay. I navigate forward. My application is deactivated. I save nothing state. And I navigate backwards. And this should mean my application gets activated again and should crash, which happens. I do this because now you see that even though I haven't changed a thing in code, there's an obvious difference between returning from a dormant state and a tombstone state. What's the difference? Well, dormant state saved my state. Returning from dormant state saved my application state. Returning from tombstone state didn't. But my application expects a certain state. It expects a local store instance. It expects a list of to-do items. It expects a current item variable. But nothing's there. And I do not go to the launching event, of course. I go to the activated event. So I need to find a way to save my state when my application gets tombstoned. It's actually pretty easy. When my application gets deactivated, I can use the state dictionary provided by the Windows Phone SDK, let's say. Phone application service.current.state. I give it a key. And I set this to my local store. Everything in this dictionary will automatically be preserved while in tombstone state. And the next thing I need to do is when my application gets activated again. Let's uncomment this. This is what I talked about before. I need to check if my application instance has been preserved. If this variable is true, I'm returning from dormant state and nothing should happen. If not, I'm returning from tombstone state. So what I do is I check if there's a local store demo item in my current state dictionary. And if yes, I set it as the current local store for this application. So I take the state from the state dictionary and I set it as the state of my application. So let's see what gives. If you run it now, we launch the application, app gets initialized. We're back here. Let's edit this. And confirm. I navigate forward. My state is saved in the state dictionary. Let's go back to the application. My application is activated again. Is application instance preserved is false, because as you remember, I'm returning from tombstone and on dormant state. So the key is in the state dictionary. I set it as the current local store. And as you can see, description 3 MSDN has been saved. My data is actually has actually been saved. Okay. So that's what saving your data or saving your state when returning from dormant or tombstone state is concerned. Now, let's go back. Here we are. Let's go back to the slides. Because this is all well when, as long as your application stays in tombstone state and stays, and the state dictionaries stay in memory. But what about when your application gets terminated? What about state 10? You need some kind of way to save state between different application instances. And this is where the isolated storage comes into play. So the isolated storage can be used to save your state data and will be preserved between different application instances. A few things to notice about this. There are no explicit quota limitations on isolated storage. For those of you who are used to working with Silverlight, you might remember that there are default quota limitations and that you have to ask the user to increase it if you need it. That's not the case with Windows Phone. However, you should of course make sure you clean it up correctly. So it could be used for temporary data. If you do it like that, well, you should of course make sure you clean up this temporary data when your application no longer needs it. It's also able to save user-generated data. That could be manipulated pictures, notes, documents. If you do this, you should probably provide the delete option. So the user can choose whether or not he wants to delete his user-generated data. Another thing that might be useful here for user-generated data is syncing it to the cloud, so it doesn't only have to be on the user's phone. And of course, it can be used for application data. That would be the options of your the application settings of your application. Of course, you do not want to delete these. Your application will rely on them for a correct function. And of course, due to all these, this is often used to persist states between different sessions. You will typically work with the isolated storage file and isolated storage file stream, which you use to save to and read from the isolated storage as files. So you typically serialize your data to a file. That's how I work. However, there's another thing you can do, and that's called the isolated storage settings. So in essence, it's two ways to work with isolated storage: through the file streams and through isolated storage settings. The nice thing about isolated storage settings is that these can immediately be bound to items in your user interface. Isolated storage file, well, you will have to read your file from isolated storage, probably cast it to the object it actually is, and then you can bind it to your UI. But isolated storage settings, these can automatically be bound to your UI. However, and that's very much personal preference rather than best practice. I kind of like having my application data, even the settings, in a class I define myself and load when I need it. Isolated storage settings, well, they save your settings automatically when the user exits the application. I rather like to be able to save myself when the save should happen or not. That's of course personal preference, but if you want to get started quickly, isolated storage settings could be the right choice. Okay. Now we're going to improve what we have. We are going to store the data in isolated storage when we close or deactivate the application, and we're going to load the data from isolated storage when we launch the application. Okay, let's go back. Here we are. I've created a little helper class for this. Isolated storage manager. This is actually a simple helper class that makes it easy for me to store typed items in my ISO store and get them from it again. So actually the two important methods are store, which accepts a file name, and an item of type T, which in my case will be our local store. And the other one of importance that we're going to use is retrieve, which will retrieve an item with given file name from my isolated storage and return it as a typed instance of a class. Okay, so let's use this. Now, let's see, where do I want to save my state so it can be used between different instances? Actually, in two places. I do not just want to save it when the app gets deactivated. I also want to save it when my application is terminated, when the closing event happens. Those are the two places where you can actually lose your state. In the activated, it will happen after Tombstone application is removed from memory. And in closing, well, it will happen by default, because that's where you end up when the application is closed, by navigating backwards. So important here is, I do not only store my state in the state dictionary, as you can see here, I also store it in isolated storage. Now you might wonder, why do I not just store it in isolated storage and always get it back from isolated storage? Why do I insist on using this state dictionary? Well, this is actually faster. If you're returning from a tombstone state, it's faster to use this state dictionary than it is to use the isolated store to read a file from and cast it to the correct type. So when my application returns to get the best user experience, I choose the one that takes the least amount of time. So when we get activated again and we're coming from Tombstone, it's better to use this dictionary and this to go to the isolated storage. Other place where I want to save my state is in the closing event. Exactly the same code. Then of course, only saving the state will do me no good. I also want to make sure my state is used when I relaunch my application. So instead of always reinitializing it, I say, well, on launch, try and retrieve my demo data, my saved file, from isolated storage. And if it exists, use that one, because it's my previous application state. Else, well, initialize a new one. Note that I said in the beginning that the launching event should always make sure the user ends up in a new, fresh application instance. So I do use this to load my data, but I will never use this to go to a specific page of the application, depending on where the user left off. That's an important difference here. Okay, so let's run this. And there we go. My application launches. Currently, there's nothing in my isolated storage. I haven't saved it yet. So I will end up with what we've already seen. Now, let's edit one. And there we go. Back, confirm. And I now need to make sure that my application state is saved to isolated storage. I can do this by going forward again, so that I end up in the deactivated event. But I've already shown that. So let's move backwards, and so I get to the closing event. So it's pretty easy. back. My application, it's closed. And my file will be written to isolate storage. And there we go, application closed. And if I start it up again, you will see the local store from ISO store now actually contains value. And here we go, my dummy 2 description still contains the changes I made previously between two different application instances. So what we now have is an application which can work with the different states and saving the correct data between different instances. Okay. Now there's another thing. I save my data to the isolated storage, but one of the best practices is you need to make sure you do not have resource intensive or long running operations in launching events or closing events or wherever. One of the things you can do here is load the data on a background thread. So instead of waiting for your application to execute until after the data has been retrieved from isolated storage, you say, well, I am going to start a new thread. My launching event can easily finish. And I'm going to do that with a background worker thread. And afterwards, I am going to get my state data back. So let's see how we can do that. That's actually pretty easy for those of you who've ever done anything with multi-threading. Here we go. So what do I do here? I create a new background worker, and its do work event will actually load the demo.txt from the isolated storage in a background thread. And after this thread has been completed, that's when the run worker completed event is launched. I say, well, okay, if there was something in my isolated storage, set it as the local store, and else, well, just initialize a new one. And of course, I still need to say, well, background worker, you can start now, so run worker async. Okay, let's have a look at that. There we go. My application launches, do work, let's put a breakpoint there. Now I'm on a background thread. The background thread has been completed. Local store has been found. And my application data I have changed is still preserved. But the launching event has been finished way earlier than before, because before I had to wait before my data was coming back, was loaded from the isolated storage, and now it's all done on a background thread. So that's actually another way to improve on this. Okay, let's see. Now, one more thing about this. Another best practice is we've now made sure the launching event doesn't take too long by putting the resource intensive work in a background thread. But also the closing event, the deactivation event, the activated event, etc., they shouldn't take long either. So instead of saving your state in those events, you could say, well, no, I want to save the state in between these events. So as you might remember from the picture in the beginning, we had the unnavigated to and unnavigated from events. Well, you can save your state in those events as well. And when you do that, you ensure that you do not have to save complete local store, in the closing or the activated event. So that again is a way to ensure your application performance gets better. So why? Because there's this 10-second limit in those events, and we want to provide a fast and responsive experience to the end user. So now we're going to use the navigation events to store state in between instead of on application closing or deactivating. Let's go back to my desktop. And what I'm going to do now, let's see, we are no longer going to save the state in the deactivated event. We do save it in the state dictionary, by the way. What I'm talking about is save for between instances. State dictionary is still faster than the other events, than the isolated storage manager. And same on application close, we do not need to save the state. Okay, now of course we do need to save the state in our application events. Where do we want to do that? In our page events, sorry, where do we want to do that? Well, when something can be changed. So when I push the confirm button, typically, that's when I want to save state. So when the confirm button is pushed, as you might remember, I navigate away from the current page. So on navigated from the one item view page, I say, well, save the state. So this is what you remember from the previous code. This may be a bit weird, or this is something new. I do not want to save the state all the time. I only want to save the state when the user presses the confirm button and moves away from the page. I do not want to save the state when the user presses the back button, because pressing the back button, well, that actually means canceling the changes or not saving them. So I simply check, am I navigating back? If not, okay, well, save state. Okay, that I don't need, so let's run this. Let's get my breakpoints away from here. You've already seen that. Edit this one. Let's add again. Change. I confirm. Normally, my state should be saved now. How can I check this? Well, I'm simply gonna stop the application and I'm gonna start it again. And as you can see, MSDN again has been preserved. So my state wasn't saved anymore in the closing event or the deactivated event. It's actually saved when navigating between pages. It's another small tip. Let's go back to the slides. Can this be improved? Well, of course it can. We've already done a few things now. We're using a background thread to load our application, so startup is faster. We're using the unnavigated event, the unnavigated from event to save state, so deactivating and closing is faster. But as you might have seen in the unnavigated from event, I still save the complete local store. Okay for this application, but in some applications where you need larger amounts of data, you might want to split up what you save a bit. Of course, you do not want to start the saving of a file to isolated storage. That takes 10 seconds. That lets your application take 10 seconds to move away from a page. You do not want to do that. So you might want to split up your state data, so you only have to save little pieces of data in your navigated from events. What else can you do? You can use the unnavigated to events to load data specific to those pages instead of doing it in one background thread in the launching event. And another small tip is using a loading screen. Of course, ensure the user doesn't have to wait 20 seconds for your data to load, because you will probably find a similar app that does things faster and offers a better experience. Okay, so that's as far as the isolated storage and application lifecycle part of this application, of this session. Now there's one new feature in Windows Home Mango I would also like to talk about with, and that's called the isolated storage database. We're all developers and we're all used to working with databases. So it might be a bit weird or look a bit weird to work with these different separate files in isolated storage. And in Windows Home Mango, there's actually a way to start working with these databases. Why would you want to do this? Not for storing a simple list of to-do items, of course. You would typically use an isolated storage database to store relational data. And what happens on the background? It's actually using Link2SQL for all database operations. It's all contained in the system.data.link assembly. And this is more or less what it looks like. So you get an application, and in your application you will define data context, and that data context will confirm to or correspond to a local database in your isolated storage. And Link2SQL runtime, that's what will be used to communicate between these. Now what does this mean for us? Well, this actually means that we need to create this data context. We need to create the data model so we can use Link2SQL on this. So what do we need to do first? We will have to create data context. It's a simple class, actually. It's a proxy representing the database containing tables. Simple as that. And typically, you would want the constructor to accept a connection string. And this class is where you will specify tables and the tables that are available in your model, say. So that's the first class we will have to create. Next, we will have to designate certain classes, certain entities, for example, our to-do item, as being a table. So you do that by using the table attribute on top of a class. So you just mark the class with the table attribute. And this will say, well, this class is associated with the database table. Next to that, you will also want to implement iNotify property changed and changing for good interaction with your UI, of course. And in that class, let's say we're still working with our to-do item. So our to-do item is now marked as being a table. There are properties, and these properties could be marked as columns. So again, with an attribute, you associate property with a column in a database table. And you will see you've got some named parameters on these. You can say, is this a primary key? Is this DB generated? What's the type? Can it be an ULL? And stuff like that. That's the easiest, fastest way. So let's have a look at that with a small demo application. Let's see. Start. There we go. This is more or less the same application as I had before, but I've added a few things just to get started quickly. It's still a to-do item application. But I've now added a to-do data context. I've also added a to-do category item that will be used in the next and last demo. But for this one, let's start with the to-do item class. Okay. First thing you will notice, it's now marked as being a table. That's the first part. So this to-do item class confirms to a table in my database. Next thing you will notice is that on some of the properties, well, in this case all of them, are attributes, are column attributes. This column attribute provides you with the possibility to add a few named parameters. say, well, this is my ID and this is the primary key. This is DB generated. That's a pretty nice feature actually. In the previous application, I had to generate my IDs myself. Now I can just say, let the database generate this. Of course, the DB type is then an integer. It's not an URL. Primary key shouldn't be an URL. And it's an identity column. Can be null. Should also be put to false, of course. And the auto sync value here, it's also a pretty interesting one. This is what says, identifies when your application or your entity in memory should be synced with the entity on your database. What I'm stating here is that when I insert an item, I should get the values back synced back from my locally saved database, from my local database. Why do I do it like this here? Because, well, this is something that can have an identity insert. So when I insert or add a new to-do item, I immediately want to get that key value back from my underlying database engine. So I have my ID, my entity. Next, there are the simple properties as we had before. I've got a name property, I've got a description property. And this is an important one as well. I also added a binary property, private one, named version. And I mark this with the column is version is true attribute. Why do I do this? Well, this actually helps update performance tremendously. So you should always do this on your classes. Okay, so that's the changes I had to make my to-do item. Now the data context. Pretty simple. I create one constructor in which I can pass in a connection string, and I specify one table of items, to-do items. So far, so good. Now let's see what I have changed to my local store. The connection string. Data source. This is pretty important. ISO store, /, and I give a name to my database. Okay, let's go to the initialization method. And let's quickly explain what we do here. First of all, I check if the database exists. If it doesn't exist, this is pretty much the same as the load dummy data Boolean value I used in the previous example. If my data context data underlying database doesn't exist, I want to create it. This will create a local database conforming to what you've set in the what you've defined in your to-do data context. So in this case, a table to-do items. I populate it with some dummy data, and I save these changes to the database. When I do the submit changes, this is actually very familiar for those of you who use Link to SQL, undoubtedly. When I submit these changes, these items will get their ID values from the underlying Link to SQL framework. And after that, it's actually the same as working with Link to SQL, more or less. I simply say, get me all my to-do items from to-do data context of to-dos. This to-dos, that's the table property I've added. And I say, well, query those and convert them to an observable collection of to-do items. That gets then set as my to-do items property, and this is again bound to my user interface. Okay. One more thing I would like to show. That's as far as fetching data is concerned. It's actually just linked to SQL. Adding an item, one more thing you have to keep in mind. You do not only have to add it to the to-dos collection on your data context and submit the changes. You also have to add it to the to-do items collection that is bound to your user interface. Why is this? Well, this to-dos collection, that's table, is of course not automatically synced to the observable collection that's bound to your UI. So that's why I'm doing this. Deleting items, exactly the same. Delete them from your data context table, submit changes, and also ensure you delete them from the list in your UI. Okay, let's run this. And here we go, my four items. First time I ran this, so we know there wasn't any database in memory. Let's edit. Okay, go back, confirm this. And I'm simply going to exit my application now. There we go. Stop. Now let's go to the application again. And you can see my data is still saved here. Thing you might have noticed, I do not do anything in my deactivated events, in my activated events, because now I am using a local database to save my data in. The data gets saved, so the state gets saved on the submit changes event, on the submit changes call on my data context. So I no longer need to save that data manually to isolated storage. It's all coming from the database. Okay. Let's see. Of course, when you're working with databases, you want to work with related data. This was a pretty simple example. But well, it's not very special. You've just got a list of to-do items on table. You will probably want to link those to-do items to another table. So for that, we can use associations. In this case, I created a to-do category, and each to-do item should have a to-do category, and a to-do category can, of course, have multiple to-do items linked to it, all the items conforming to that category. So for this, you use the association attribute. So how do you do that? You mark property with it and say, well, you add an entity reference on the singleton side of the application, on the singleton side of your data, actually. This entity reference, in our case, this would be a category reference on a to-do item. And the other way around, you add an entity set on the collection side of the application, which would mean in our category we would have an entity set of to-do items. This is to enable navigation from and to or between categories, to-do items, etc. in an easy way. If you look at all this, this is actually what we are now doing manually, what happens automatically when you use an ORM design tool like we used to do with Link to SQL earlier, or a bit the same as we do with the entity framework now. This is the same as you did then, you're just doing it manually. And it's really not that hard. And one thing, you would also want to use the entity set constructor to add and remove handlers that need to be executed when the entity set gets items added or removed, added to or removed from it. This will sound a lot more clear in 2 minutes. So let's show that. Okay, so I've created a to-do category. Let's uncomment this quickly. There we go. I'm just going to focus on the changes a bit. Here we go. When I access a to-do category, I will want to navigate to the to-do items related to this category. So this is the collection side of my application of my data model. So I create an entity set of to-do items. I make a public property, which is an entity set of to-do items, named to-dos. And I say, well, form an association, store this item in the underscore to-dos property, which is this one. On the other side of the relation or the association, link this to category ID. This is what we'll need to define on to-do item. And on this side, link it to ID. This is the ID of the to-do category. Then I do the same in to-do item, but the other way around. Oh, let's have a look at that. I create an entity reference to one item, a category. And I say, well, form an association between to-do item and to-do category. This key is category ID on this side, category ID on to-do item. Other key on the to-do category is ID. This is, of course, a foreign key. And store it in the category variable, private variable on to-do item, which is here. By doing this, I can now navigate from each to-do item to the related category, one item, and I can navigate from each to-do category to the entity set of to-do items. Also created an extra constructor here. Okay. I, of course, need to specify my categories table in my data context. And then let's look at the local store again. First of all, I've added a property to make this bit bindable to my UI. That's not too special. Of course, need to initialize it as well. And this is my old code. So let's remove that. What do I want to do now? I will want to, first of all, check if my database exists again. If not, I create a database. In this case, I need to add a bit of more dummy data. So instead of just having to-do items, I also create a few categories. I create two categories, I insert them, and I create a few to-do items linked to one of those categories. This is a special one. As you can know, if you're using Link to SQL, you can add items in different ways. I can add a to-do item by adding one to my to-dos collection and passing in the category. But I can also say, well, no, I want to add a to-do item by navigating to the category and going to that one's to-dos collection. So that's exactly the other way around. So this is one way, add a new to-do item to the to-dos collection on my data context, passing in the category, or select the category, its to-do item collection, and add one to that. No need to pass in the category anymore, of course. And this is why in the slide I said you can use the entity set of to-do items constructor to add handlers that should happen on adding and removing of these items. And that's exactly what I did here. What I'm stating here is, if a to-do item is added to the to-dos collection of this category, execute this. If it's removed, execute this. So let's go there. When a to-do item is added, set its category to this category. When it's removed, set the category to new. By having this code, this ensures my code will still function correctly, my application will still function correctly. And this means I can actually write code like this, add a to-do item without having to pass in the category or anything. Because when I execute this code, the handler will get executed, then a new to-do item has been added to the list of to-do items for this category, and its category will be set to this one automatically. Okay, we're almost there. The other code is actually the same as before, with that difference that I'm now also loading the categories. And of course, a simple thing I need to change when I add an item, I need to give it a default category. Now, one little trick. I've changed my data context, so I've changed my data model. So the previous model will no longer be valid according to this current data context. This means I should probably migrate my data context. I'm not going to do that now. I am going to explain in two lines how you can do that on the next slide. The little trick is just close your emulator and let it start up again, and your IsoStore will be empty, and the database will be recreated automatically. Okay, so let's run this. There we go. Still got some breakpoints in here. And we now have items with their categories visible. And we can, of course, add and edit them, etc. But I'm just going to go back to my my slides to finish this up. Okay, so that's working with a local database. It's actually very, very much the same as you're used to with Link2 SQL or even with the Entity Framework, with that big difference that you create your data context on your own and you add the necessary associations and column properties manually. But when working with related data, it is actually worth it. This is what I was talking about as far as database updating is concerned. If your schema has been updated, you can use the database schema updater class to change the schema of your saved database in the isolated storage. Important here is you can perform additive operations, so you can add columns. But for other operations, you will have to write code to migrate the database. That's pretty normal if you change an MS SQL database and you start deleting some columns. Well, you would have to write code to migrate it as well. You can also use indexing. It's pretty nice, actually, to improve performance of your app. So the isolated storage DB has support for indexing. You just define them at the table level with a code like this, so an index attribute. And your database can actually be encrypted. How do you do that? It's also very easy. The first time, before you create a database, provide a password in the connection string. And all the other times, when you want to access the database, you will need to provide that password, or else you won't have access. Now, what are the limitations and differences? Well, you might be used to having a database running on a server somewhere, and you might have a few applications accessing that same database. So that's not possible here. Your local database runs in the Windows Phone applications process. It does not run continuously as a background service. So your app starts up, your application starts up, your database starts up. It's not accessible by other applications, therefore. So your database can only be accessed by the corresponding Windows Phone application. The database, of course, resides in isolated storage, and isolated storage is limited in Windows Phone to corresponding application. And you access it with Link2 SQL, so no writing our own TSQL queries. So what do you want to use, or what would you what are some best practices on choosing between using isolated storage and local database. Of course, to get started, you do need to define the context and the model, the associations, the column types, etc., etc. So it does take a bit more work to get started with local database. But when you're working with related data, it's worth it because you can easily access it through Link, which is very, very powerful technology. So don't do it for speed, because in essence you're writing to isolated storage, whether you're using a database on top of that. Limiting factor here is disk input output. So true speed difference won't be that much. So what I would do, I would choose a local database if you're working with related data. Use it for relational data and querying. And if you're working with unrelated data or simple lists, I would use simple isolated storage. Okay, time for the conclusion. Of course, as we have seen, the application lifecycle is very important for a good user experience. Keep it in mind when designing an application. Use the different states and events to ensure correct loading, correct saving, fast application experience for your user. And use local database when working with relational data.